Welcome to the Share Life podcast with Jason Scott Montoya, where we explore stories and systems to live better and work smarter. Welcome to an inspirational people interview episode of the Share Life podcast. I'm Jason Montoya, and today I'm here with Stephen Hadaway. Stephen, say hello.
Hello, everybody. Good to see you guys.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us today and sharing your life. Stephen is a comedian. You might see him around town. He's also the online campus pastor at Victory World Church. Me and Stephen got connected through our mutual friend, which is Jessica Lally, Voices to Connect.
And today,
Stephen's going to tell us about his story, and we're going to dive into systems and ideas, mentoring, and a variety of other things. So before we jump into those questions, Stephen, tell us about you and your story.
Again, thanks for letting me be here today. Hello, everyone. Glad to be able to talk a little bit about just this crazy experience that God has brought me through that has led me to, I don't know, that's a weird connection, right? When you look at maybe doing ministry and also telling jokes, that's a fun cohesion of the two. And people ask me all the time, how do you do both of those? What leads you in that kind of direction? And I think even like I get questions all the time about how you got to, to go towards deciding to be a pastor. Even if somebody is thinking that might be something that I would like to do one day, how did you start that journey? How does one go down that road? How did you even know that you wanted to go into that field? That's something that is always fun to talk about. But nobody asked me why I like to do comedy, because I think everybody has a built-in aspect of liking to laugh and wanting to tell jokes. And I think there's a little bit of a dream that people have inside of them of wanting to be able to be that kind of person. Yeah. Everyone loves comedy. Everyone loves to laugh, but not everybody likes to
This at you just as a little question. I read this book by Kevin Rowe about Christian leadership recently. And in one of the chapters, there's a quote that he says, "Laughter is a sign that we refuse to give in to brokenness."
Laughter is a sign that we refuse to give in to brokenness. I think brokenness is like
embracing despair. Laughter helps remind us that we have something to hope for, right?
I think so. And one of the reasons why I like humor is because I went through a lot of dumb stuff growing up. So people will ask me, how did you get to be funny? I'm broken. And that was my way to cope with some horrible tragedies over and over again. And I think that I never wish for somebody to go through difficult circumstances. But whenever I do go through hard times, my mind is always going towards, how can I turn this into a joke? So I was at a comedy club last night in Lawrenceville. And I was talking with the guy who puts on the club. I haven't seen him in about a month. And his name is John Chappell. The club, it meets at Slow Pour Brewery every, the second Monday, Wednesday of every month. He puts on a fun little shindig. So I haven't seen him in a month. I was like, how are things going? He said, I almost died. I was in a hospital for 4 days. I was sick for 10. The doctors told me I had 20. If I hadn't waited 24 hours to come to the hospital, I would have passed away because I was in sepsis. My organs were shutting down.
Wow.
And he's telling me all of this stuff. But here's what's funny is I my next question to him was, so you got some jokes about it? I cannot wait for you to get on stage. And he's like, that's what I'm doing. Whenever I go through something, my initial thought is, how can I laugh about this? How can I begin to tell a humorous side to it? And I can even think of the most embarrassing moment of my life when it was happening. I felt like God spoke to me in my heart and said, you're going to joke about this on stage. Don't worry about it. This is going to be good. And so I love that quote. You're going to have to send that to me through an email so I can pretend like it's my own later on in life.
Yeah, so tell us about this story that you endured.
I also don't want to be too dramatic, because as I begin to share it, there have been people who have been through a lot worse than what I have been. I just like to pretend that mine is worse. So here's what happened. When I grew up in a great family that took me to church, and I remember going to different churches in the area, and my mom and dad raising me in a household of faith. But my dad began to go through some difficult circumstances that caused him to be disillusioned with how he thought life should go. And he began
to blame himself or with church or everything
with his job. And then, some really unfair things happened in his life.
And how old was he when that happened?
I think he was around in his mid-40s, probably around then. So I'm sure the whole midlife fun stuff was kicking in
at
the same time. And you begin to look and say, this is not what I thought it was going to be.
Or what I was told too, right?
Exactly. What people told me it was going to be. And that's one of the reasons why I can't stand prosperity gospel when it comes to the message of faith, because people built up a false illusion of who God really is. And then when reality hits, they're like, what's going on over here? I thought it was supposed to be sunshine and rainbows. I read that My Best Life Now book, and this is not what I was expecting. No call out. So the last thing I want to do is call out any pastors that have maybe written a book like that. So we're not going to talk about Joel Osteen because I don't want to mention his name and people get offended. So one of the things that my dad was going through is being disillusioned. And as a result, we began to drift from a family of going to church and being in a faith community. Plus a whole bunch of other mess began to come around as well. My dad was dealing with a lot of other things. Like my father, I'm going to go deep right away. My father back in the 80s was trans before trans was cool. So that caused my mom and him to have some big disagreements. It ended up leading to them getting a divorce. Plus there was alcohol and other things. Yeah. So my parents got a divorce.
So how was that in terms of the timeline? How is that in terms of the midlife disillusionment? Is that happening at the same time, or is this after or before?
Right around in his 40s as well.
Okay.
So I was later elementary, beginning middle school, around fifth, sixth grade. So watching my parents go through divorce is hard, because like my mom got the house and he got her clothes, which, trans joke there. Go ahead.
Yeah. So you're obviously... I don't even know, like, most people go through divorce and just on a serious note, it's the challenging, difficult thing. And then you have these other dynamics that sort of make it more complex, right? So is that even something that's registering for you when it's happening? Or is it kind of almost not even there in terms of what's happening?
Great question. How was I coping as elementary and middle school student as all these things were going down? You know, there's an aspect of kids that are resilient. And that's something that a lot of parents say, like, kids are resilient. They bounce back. You know, if I was to fall off the monkey bars at school, I'm walking away with a shattered hip. They bounce up and down and it was fun. And they take off running again because kids just have that built-in resiliency. I hear that. I don't want to disagree with it. But some of the reason why kids are resilient is because they just learn to cope, to try to survive. So everything horrible is going on around them, and they're losing their family. They're watching the patriarch of their family start to walk away from everything they said that was important. They're watching their mom begin to lose their mind. My mom told me later, like, she was on the verge of a breakdown as well, because she was going through all this mess. And so as a child, I'm wanting to, like, everything's going to be okay. So I'm just like stuffing stuff down, going, how can I get through this? Everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine. And plus also I started to take myself to church during those moments. My mom would take me and drop me off and say, I'm so proud of you for going to church. Okay, I'll be back in 2 hours. Bye. She would leave, and I knew there was something there. I felt like God was working in my heart, trying to move forward. So there were some faith elements there, but there are sometimes when kids survive something, that does not mean that once, 5 years later, everything's sunshine and rainbows. It means that they have to still have to go back and walk through some of those difficult moments, because when you push things down, it's just going to come up later. It sticks with us. And there are still things that I'm learning and processing even now. But as far as coping, laughter, I was definitely bullied a lot at school. Understandably, I was a goofball. And
did people know about what your dad was, the transition he was making?
No. That was before it was cool. So yeah. It was very, very, very closed.
But if they had found out, would that have made the bullying even worse?
Oh my gosh. Yes. That would have been so like my bullies needed anything else to teach me about. You know, I gave them plenty to talk about with my overweight self and my Walmart shoes. Okay. I couldn't afford to pump Air Jordans like everybody else. So I remember my mom bought me, she tried her best. God bless her. She bought me the Walmart version of pumps. Please tell me you know what the pumps are.
Yeah.
I know I'm still showing my age. So there was
growing up. So I knew those.
Perfect. So I'm wearing Voight's version of Nike. And I was like, finally, I'm starting to be cool. No. It was merciless roasting as I got into school. And that's great. That was also good for me as well. I mean, that's
in terms of developing resilience.
Yeah, resilience, learning how to respond to people that are throwing mess at you, understanding that some of the reason why they're roasting me is because they've got some of their own issues that they're dealing with as well.
So did you have someone that was helping to empower, encourage, and develop you through that?
Great question.
Or were you on
like
your own?
Like a mentor or something? Yeah, totally. Totally on my own. The only kind of beaming light that I had in my life is I had a childhood friend. That I would go and spend the night with maybe a couple times a year. And this family went to church and read their Bible together. And going there was an oasis. And so the dad was driving me home once. And I remember I'm going home and I'm asking him, like, I love your family. How did you get to be a family that loves God? And he's like, well, because my family was not like this at all. And I made a decision when I was your age, Stephen, that I was going to build a family that stood on the principles of the Word of God, and that my family would love the Lord. It's pretty much did like the whole Joshua thing, you know, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And then I realized, oh, I could decide that. I could make a decision of what my kids are going to look like and what my future could be. Oh, wow. I just thought that I have to play the cards with the hand that I'm dealt, which you do. But, you know, I'm also best friends. I'm learning with the dealer. He can help me make a winning hand of what looks like something that's horrible. That was probably the only aspect of my life that was helpful. Teachers, so, I remember. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, with your dad transitioning, it seems like, because I've been listening to stories, because a lot of the trans movement now is actually younger people. So before it was with adults, and now it's with teenagers and kids. So what I was hearing from one of the parents was they was like their child, they had lost their child. And so I'm curious if that was your experience in the sense of you lost your dad, right? You lost your dad because now I don't know how do you make sense of that? Or did you see it that way? Or did you see it differently?
No, I hear that. My dad was looking into getting surgeries. But he was like I had mentioned before, he was dealing with a lot of emotions and hurt. He actually had such strong depression that he began to see doctors on what can I do to get help with this. Was seeing counselors and was taking medication to help him. Also had addiction to over the counter medication, and he was finding ways to get his fix. He had some back pain as well. And back pain is the worst, and people will take anything to get rid of it. And that's he was doing everything to try to get better, but he was fighting very real demons, you know, and I mean that in a spiritual sense, but also in mental battle things that he was facing. So he was looking into going through that change. But outwardly, people knew him. We shared the same name. Outwardly, people knew him as Stephen, but his very, very close friends, people knew him to live a different kind of lifestyle. So that was something that he was still kind of protected. But knowing that, he still tried to be a dad as best he could to me. But he was also dealing with going into rehab centers, homeless, moving from extended stay to extended stay. He had done, listen to this. This is something that completely shocked me when I learned it. And I don't mean that as a pun, because he had shock therapy to try to cure him of his depression, which the late 90s, I had no idea that shock therapy was still seen as a valid form of treatment for somebody that was going through. I mean, I remember hearing that was back in the 60s and the 70s, they would do outlandish things to try to help people. I was like, man, is it shock therapy with a couple of leeches on your arm? What are they doing?
Yeah. And well, it's funny. I don't know if you ever seen the movie Return to Oz.
I don't think I've seen it, no.
Oh, okay. It was a movie I grew up with. It's kind of like a horror version of The Wizard of Oz. It's a sequel. And
that sounds cool.
Yeah, it scared me as a kid. But I rewatched it with my kids recently. And the premise of the movie is this Dorothy has lost her mind because of this experience she thinks she has. So they take her to a mental institute. And they take her into this dungeon to do this shock therapy and all these things to her. And she ends up escaping, and then she goes back to Oz. But the whole premise was just bizarre that her parents would drop her off at this dungeon to be treated. It was such a good example of what you're describing.
So quick question. Is that the one where one of the characters was like a talking pumpkin?
Yes. Talking pumpkin. Okay. I think
I saw that one.
Yeah. And there's the queen who takes her head off, and she has different heads that she puts on her body. The rollerblader.
That's crazy.
The rollerblader guys. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. My Lord, if there's any ever a case for what mushrooms can do when a person's creativity, that movie sounds like a great case study.
But it sounds like it might have been a little bit more real than just a fantasy there, based on your dad's experience. It was,
because he told me that when I go through this, they said one of the side effects is going to be my short-term memory is going to be shot. And I saw that happening in front of me, where I was, there were several areas where I was losing them. And even to the point where he ended up trying to take his life a couple of times. I remember getting a call in the middle of the night to go to the hospital, because he had tried to take his life. And sitting with him while he's being inspected by doctors, unfortunately he was successful when I was 25, around that age. And it was, that was a really crazy, watching that full progression of what he was going through. So when I was in middle school, And now probably around ninth grade, I think is when the divorce happened. The way that impacted not just my relationship with him, but also with my mom, is my mom was a teacher at Monroe, at high school in Monroe, which is very country compared. For those of you who are watching, like, Monroe, what does that mean? It's just even the name Monroe, just some Monroe. I'm not sure how that came up. But that's right beside another town called Between. And you know why it's called Between? It's because it's between two other cities. So they said, let's just call it Between. And that name stuck. So my mom was a high school teacher and did not make enough funds like what my father had made to be able to support us financially. And because she had been volunteering at a homeless shelter that's in Lawrenceville as a Christian homeless and rehabilitation center called the Quinn House, she was a cosmetologist. She taught people. She had learned how to cut hair and was teaching that at the high school. She served at the shelter. Guys would come in either off the streets or from prison. A lot of guys would come there straight from prison. She would volunteer her time to make sure they all had great haircuts, especially for when they would go to a job interview to try to get back up on their feet. And they knew what we were going through. And that my mom was getting close to potentially losing the house. It was not far away. Like, it's either sell it or you could lose the house. So she worked with somebody to sell it. And when she did, we needed a place to go. And she said to me, hey, listen, if you want, this lady has invited us to move into the shelter. If you want to, you can move in there. I'm going to go get an apartment with a friend. So I did. I moved into the shelter by myself, which as a 14, 15 year old, which was so weird. Like, in the process of my father stepping away, trying to figure out how he could be healthy, and my mom figuring out what it's like to lose her husband and questioning, like, am I the reason why he's going in this direction? Like, well, that's all the games that she was fighting with. She was a great mom, but was finding her own way as well, which kind of meant there were some very real aspects where I felt by myself in the shelter with guys who were recovering addicts. They had about 10 to 12 other boys there that were given to them this ministry by the state of Mississippi because they had been taken away from their families. And one of them specifically, his name was Stanley. I think he had 12 to 14 convicted felonies and was 12 years old at the time. And this was, it was another thing that I look back and I can truly say that all things work together for good, because God used so much of that to help me understand what other people were going through. Like, anytime you feel like it's rough, I'm looking at one of these guys, his name was Rufus, and watched his mom murdered in front of his eyes. And now he's one of my roommates. This was something that was great for me, and preparing me, I think, for some of the things that God had for me in the future. And about 6 months later, my mom moved into the shelter. She went through some more difficult situations. So we're living in there. And, that's where my faith truly became real for me. I had been attending on Sundays for a long while, and I knew that God was a part of my life. I would pray occasionally, and I would read the Bible, but it was more recreational as opposed to relational and how I would connect with God. But I met people who would read the Bible and then believed it. And that was unusual for me. Like, yeah, mm-hmm. Jesus can save me, but people would read it and they would go to Romans 8:28. Hey, all things can work together for the good of those who love God and who are called according to his purpose. And they would apply that to their life. And I would go, gosh, that doesn't sound like real to me. How could that be real? How can I understand and have a relationship with God? That's where everything I think in my life began to change. And I would say towards a future for what I would want to see. My dad, you know, didn't teach me all the dad things as far as like how to change oil, how to take care of the house. Like if someone were to ask me how to fix stuff at a house, I am embarrassingly ignorant. I just don't know any of that stuff. I didn't have a dad who took me up and showed me it along the way.
Well, now YouTube is our dad, right? It tells us how to do it.
Yes, yes. Like that YouTube channel, Dad, How Do I is the name of it. And he shows people how to do all this stuff.
Yeah.
I fixed a sink because of that channel. Thank you, Dad, How Do I, and what you do out there. So that's oh, man. And that's like Paul said, you got a lot of teachers, but not many fathers. And that's, we are in a generation without dads, which is very, I think as you had mentioned earlier, we're seeing younger and younger cases of things that we would say would be, we would see youth and children and young adults go directions that we would think is not healthy for them, are not that could be detrimental to who God has called them to be. And a lot of that is because they don't have a father to sit them down and talk to them and love them and speak value and purpose and calling into them. And as a 17, six, it was, I was 16, and that 16 is about the age people say, what you going to do with your life? And I was clueless. I had no idea. I didn't have a father who would sit me down, who helped me develop skills. And I was terrified, as I'm sure a lot of people are, by that question. I didn't know what in the world God had for me or even what I was supposed to. All I know is I'm living in a shelter with a bunch of addicts. And I was homeschooled. Then I went to do homeschool while I was there as well. And it was like, I don't know what God has for me. But I began to sincerely pray and seek God. And my burden for me was for people to know just how of a personal relationship they could have with Jesus. Because I remember thinking, like reading the Bible and go, oh, wait a minute. God wants me to talk to him? Yes. He wants you to pray. Okay. All right. Wait, you mean God has a plan? Yeah. And there were so many things I believed about God that was not true, that were easy to dispel if I would just read the letters that he had given me in the Word of God and use that to form how I understand his character, not just my experiences. And I think that's what a lot of people do. They'll use what their circumstances are in life to determine who they think God is like. And I knew kids in the youth group that I was attending that was the case. Okay, so here's an example. I invited some of my friends from my youth group to come to the shelter because I wanted to do a Bible study with them. And they showed up, and there was a brand new NC-17 movie that had just come out called Showgirls. That it was like the first one that ever hit the theater, and was getting all these crazy news stories about it, you know, focused on the family. You know, they were popping a nerve because it was out there. And so we're having this Bible study, and one of the kids in the youth group that I attended was bragging about just having seen the movie. And another person in the room was bragging about, and I don't want to say bragging, but like not ashamed of their drug use as well. And I'm looking at my friends that are being destroyed by the enemy. We are in a very real spiritual war, and that was becoming real to me. And I'm thinking, gosh, there's so much more, God, that you have for them. And they're finding themselves in brokenness. I know pornography is going to break this person. If that's how they see women based upon that movie, that's going to affect any future relationships. Like it's going to affect his wife, his marriage, his daughters, if he has any. God, you have so much more for them. So I'm praying for all of my friends that are in this scenario, primarily students. And I felt one day the Lord supernaturally just say to me in my heart, it was a weird moment. We're driving back. My mom and I were in the car. We're driving back from my grandfather's funeral in Miami. And I'm laying back. She's driving. I'm 16. And I'm thinking about them, praying for them. And I felt something so clear in my heart. It was not an audible voice from the Lord or anything. It's not like I heard Charleston Heston's deep voice speaking to me. Stephen, all right. It wasn't any of that. Just something that was so clear. It was almost shocking to me of, I want you to do youth ministry. It was so shocking that I sat up violently from my chair, and my mom, who was driving, was like, what's wrong? Nothing. And then I leaned back like, was that God? I don't know if that was God or not. I get home. My mom had just moved. We had just moved out of the shelter. She had married somebody that was a guest in the shelter who had just been released from prison for attempted murder. It was my new stepdad. It was great. Great family dynamic bonding opportunity. And I get home that night, and I go to my room. I'm praying. I'm like, God, I don't know if that was you. Was that you? I don't think it was you, because I'm excited about that. I would love to do that. And you wouldn't, if it was you, it would probably be something I don't like. Isn't that crazy? Sometimes I don't know why we feel like the plan God has for us is probably going to be something we don't like. And that was something that I fought through. And I remember saying, God, if this is what you want, could you just make it clear to me? And then I'll pursue it. I'll run after it. And so I went to bed. I'm like, less than 5 minutes later, my mom walks into the door. I hadn't told anybody about that experience. And she says, you know what? I just got a phone call from our pastor. And he said that God told him what you're supposed to do with your life. Isn't that weird? And I was like, what? Okay, I'm going to call him. No, you're not going to call him. It's 10:30. You can go see him tomorrow. And it's not like I had been telling people, I'm thinking about youth ministry. I did not think about youth ministry. I was not considering it. I was like, what else am I supposed to do? My mom was trying to get me to also be a hairstylist. She's like, I make bank on this. You should try to do this too. I'm like, I don't want to be a hairstylist. So I didn't know what I was supposed to do. But I went to my pastor's house the next day, and I told him my experience. And he said, that's exactly what I feel like God told my wife and I as we were praying for you. And I just began to run after youth ministry right at 16. And I just knew that was what I was supposed to do. It wasn't
That was 2 years after you were in the homeless shelter?
Yeah, actually, I moved in when I was 15.
Okay.
So around 14, 15. We was there for over a year. My mom married somebody in the shelter. We were living in a house in Lawrenceville, but it wasn't very long afterwards that we moved back into the shelter because my mom and her husband helped to run one of the houses that they had. So that was, I moved back in there until I got married, which was 21 years old. The lady who was running it, her and her husband ended up being like grandparents to me. I call her granny. Her name is Carol Quinn. The name of the shelter is the Quinn House. Still operational today. My mom and her new husband, my mom said I could share this stuff. I'm not throwing her under the bus. She married somebody else, and now they are both directors of the ministry that helped to run it today.
Oh wow!
And I still volunteer there, still involved, and had such a big impact in my life. I'm super grateful for that spot. But that was the ministry has been such a key part in so much of my story.
Yeah. So how do you get from there to now you're married and now you're at Victory World Church? What happens between those two places?
I love this place. All right, so I began to run after youth ministry. I started serving at a youth ministry in the area that I loved. I was still 16. So as I was going there, I ended up meeting my now wife and dated her friend. Her friend and I broke up. But we were still good friends. And my wife and I just began to hang out in that same friend group and begin to like each other. And then a couple years later, we got married. I was 21. She was 20. And when we wanted to do a cruise for our honeymoon, and we went to the travel agent, which there were travel agents back then with real brick and mortar stores. You hear me? You met back in my day, we had travel agents. So we went to this lady and she's like, you can't do a cruise. I'm like, what do you mean we can't do a cruise? Well, your wife isn't old enough. What? Yeah, she's 20 and no cruise line is going to let her go without parental supervision. Can I be her guardian? I'll be her husband. No, it doesn't count. Her mom or dad have to go on the cruise unless you do a Disney cruise. Then Disney's the only cruise line that will let you guys actually honeymoon together. So we didn't want to do Disney. We would love Disney. We love the mess out of it. But for a honeymoon, the travel agent said, don't listen to that. You'll love it. They're the best cruise line out there. And she was right. We went on that cruise and it was amazing. And so the church that we met at, got married at, I began I was actually serving. My job at the time was a door-to-door cemetery plot salesman. So I would walk up, you know, to someone's house, knock on their door, and then ask them if they have they thought about when you're going to die? Because here I am. I'd love to chat with you about it. And that was such a unique role. That was good in getting you outside of your comfort zone.
Sell a plot?
Yes, I did. Hadaway making it happen. They call me the closer. I only closed a couple. Actually, that's strange, right? Okay. A little bit of behind the scenes with the cemetery salesman, most of the people that we would talk to that would say, yeah, we are thinking about this would either be older, they're 6 years older, that then they're actually thinking about it. You know, if you were to meet a young couple in their early 20s, they're usually not excited about it unless they just walk through a situation where someone dies tragically and their family member did not plan at all. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, that's a lot of weight. When you have to pick, you know, that's why some funeral homes can be kind of shady because they can use your emotions to say, you could get them this casket, but this casket does this and that. And it's like, don't ever go to one of those places by yourself. Bring a friend with you that can keep you from going.
Buying the gold-plated casket.
Yes, that happens. In fact, I went to one funeral and the casket had drawers in it. I took pictures of it because I thought I want to make jokes about this later. But drawers that like they're taking things with them, you know, when you put them into the ground. So it's
like an Egyptian tomb.
Exactly. But you know, without the sand, you know, Georgia red clay, weird stuff. So that's that I did that for a while until the pastor of the church that I was going to said, hey, we know you love youth ministry and that you want to be a youth pastor one day. How about, you know, we don't have a job for you, but how about you come on as our janitor and our yards guy and that we will be at the church. And I jumped on that, man. I was so excited. I just wanted to be at the church. I could care less what I was doing. Just give me a chance I'll paint walls, I'll cut grass if I get a chance to speak into students' lives. And this church was really instrumental in giving me opportunities and giving me a shot. In fact, the youth pastor that was there is the one who saw some potential in me and took risks on me. A good friend of ours, Rodney Bradley, and ended up being the officiant at our ceremony. And we're still good friends with him. In fact, I got to pastor his sons, which was amazing. I love that. Such a cool full circle. And my kids and his kids are friends. It was just really cool what God did in my life while I was at that church. And eventually, Victory reached out to me and gave me a shot to come on as a pastor, a middle school pastor. I was in 2007.
So you didn't have to start as a janitor there.
I didn't. I didn't. In fact, okay, let me just say, when I interviewed with them, they're like, okay, so we're going to hire you as a middle school pastor, and that's all you have to do. You don't have to paint walls. We just want you. We see value in middle school students, and we want you to only focus on helping them understand their faith, understand what is how to that there is a place where they belong. Those are awkward years. In fact, you know, there's a lot of studies that show it's the most formative years in your entire life. Is your where you're at in middle school, like around 10 to 14, 15 years old. So much happens in how you see the world in those years. And I got a chance to be at a church that said, we want you to just focus on this age range. And man, what a gift that was. In fact, I even felt like that helped me a little bit with comedy, because middle school students, there is some awkwardness in them, and keeping their attention is hard. Very hard. And so I'm doing four services on a weekend. I'm taking very big spiritual moments and trying to help them understand at their level and keep their attention. And I used humor to be able to do that. I mean, if you can preach at nursing homes or prison ministry, you can minister to middle school students by far. I love that. And still, like, once you're a youth pastor, there's the element to you're always a youth pastor. It's such a cool calling that the Lord allowed me to walk in. And so
middle to online.
All right. So I did middle school and high school ministry, and that's actually where I began. Like, I always loved to crack jokes. I remember the first joke that I cracked when I was like maybe 4 years old. My parents had friends at the house, and I thought of something funny. I said it, even though I knew I was going to get in trouble. I got in trouble. My mom threatened to spank me in front of my friends and followed through after they left, which was probably good for me. But that feeling of making someone laugh is addicting, that because you're giving someone joy, especially when you make someone laugh that's going through a difficult time. Yeah. That's one of the best feelings in the world. So I always had that wanting to move in that direction. But when I came to Victory, the senior pastor at the time, he's the founding pastor, Pastor Dennis Rouse, him and Pastor Colleen love comedy. In fact, like he has a friend that he helped get into the business. And he listened to me preach once, heard some of my humor. And one day, it was his birthday, and we're at a staff advance where we're getting together to make some plans for the future. And his birthday happened to be in that. And his assistant said, "Hey, we're all going to get together and roast the pastor for his birthday," which is the dumbest idea ever. Never roast a pastor, especially when he's your boss, right? That was weird, because there's such a church culture of honor, which I believe we are called by God to honor those who are leading the way for us. But so much respect, I think, is given for someone who brings in laughter and doesn't mind being, the butt of a joke. You know, you can jest with somebody without it being dishonoring. Absolutely. Yeah. Like, you know, when a friend's gone too far, when you're joking around with them. And so that's our pastor. There are some pastors that would never let you make a joke about them, but he's like, "Bring it on. Let's have some fun." So I said the joke in there that, by God's grace, killed. I mean, the entire like the guys and girls that were in that room, some of the other pastor leaders, one started crying, one leaned over because his gut was hurting. And it was probably the scariest I've ever been to tell a joke, because I knew that it could not just go bad for me, but I could lose my job. but I still wanted to risk it. I could have just been quiet, but I wanted to roll the dice, because I thought, this is going to be funny, or I could get fired, but I think it's going to be funny. Let's see what happens. And it landed so well, to the fact where afterwards the senior leadership team got together and said, "Hey, for our Christmas party, let's have Stephen host it and he can tell some jokes." So they asked me to do that, and I did. And I did it for like 9 years in a row. It was awesome. I had one or two bombs, which is rough. You know, I have bombs several times. It's not like every joke I throw out there is golden. In fact, bombs are even better for you than getting good laughter, because it helps you know what's funny and when you're not. So, why is that a part of online? Cause it got to the point where our senior pastor sat down with me and said, "Okay, listen," I was a high school pastor at the time, And he said, Stephen, we're seeing more and more people attend with us online than ever before. We have thousands of people that watch on the weekend. It's our biggest attendance, if you would think about it that way. And we're not pastoring them. They're watching, but nobody is shepherding them. No one is calling them to higher action personally. And we're missing it as a church, not having that. And the way that people are engaging online is through humor. And we know you do open mics in the area. We know you do comedy. You do comedy for us on a regular basis. We'd like to ask you to consider going to being our online pastor, because we think the comedic bent that you can bring can help people stay engaged. And we know that you love people. We know that you can pastor as well. So would you be interested in that? It's not like, oh, by the way, this was like in 2019 before COVID. So it was really cool to be a part of a church that did not think about online just when the entire world shut down and it was the only option. But our pastor was like, we need to solve this now. I knew that it was not a passing fad either, right? It's not like online is going to be around like slap bracelets just for a little while or like the pump shoes, but it's
our pods,
you know, our Kathy Griffin. Yes. Our pods. Yes. So those things were hilarious. I forgot about those little things on the ground. So that was something that, I was like, yeah, I could see myself moving in that direction. So I took the role, and eight months later, I think is when the world shut down and everything was online, which was what a roller coaster that was for everybody. That was, so I'm grateful that we were able to pre-think some of that beforehand, but the world is only going to continue to go in that direction. Like Apple Vision, that's coming out next year. The future of augmented reality and virtual reality and how much our cell phones and the way we connect digitally is continuing to grow. And I don't think it's great for the church to sit back and watch it go by, but do creatively and with some innovation, look at it and go, all right, yes, it's a tool. And some people see that it could be used for bad, but how can we use it for good? How can we use it to help people, to connect with them, to lead them to community, to help them in their discipleship journey? And here's kind of how I see it. I feel like I'm talking too much. Feel free to jump in if I'm going too much. But I like the idea of how Paul was hanging out in a city and saw just how far from God they were. They were very spiritual. They had idols everywhere, but they were far from the Lord. And he watched them, and his heart was grieved for them. So he started doing some open air ministry and preaching. And his sermon illustration were the idols. He stood by an idol and said, hey, look at this idol to the unknown God. I cannot wait to tell you about him. And that unknown God was not written about, you know, Jehovah. It was not about, let us tell you about Jesus. It was created so that, I bet there's a God out there we've forgotten about. Let's make this one so that, you know, all of our bases are covered. Paul saw what the devil had used for evil and said, I can use this for good, and used it to eventually lead people into the faith. Which is weird and unusual and different and offended people. I know it. But that's the side of ministry that I like, that I think online could be, is there's potential in our streaming. There's potential in Zoom small groups and helping people connect through Facebook groups, or in a virtual reality preaching, you know, looking at an avatar that might be an example of me, but it's a cartoon version. And I'm preaching, and people can come in and ask me questions about the faith that are deconstructing. And hey, how come the church hasn't called out all of the pedophilia that's out there? How come this church has moved priests and pastors around? How come this guy is wearing $30,000 of clothes when he preaches? These are questions that people have that the church has shied away from answering, you know, except for preachers and sneakers on Instagram. But you know, I love the thought of answering some of that stuff and even addressing some of it in my comedy as well, because people already have these questions. They're already thinking about them. And I love being able to say, let's talk about it, instead of, you know, sweeping it under the rug, just pretend that didn't happen. That's not the case anymore, man. When stuff hits the internet, it's there for forever. And if you ignore it, people will lose what they see as validity in your faith. And that's okay.
Yeah, it's good. So what would be like would there be any principles or values for someone that for someone that is maybe a church or someone that's in your role in a different church, to navigate the online church, are there any guiding principles that you?
Yes. So a lot of what I'm going to share with you is connected to someone that I have learned from as well. I'm not the first guy to the online realm. There have been people who've been doing it for a long while, like Jeff Reed, who does some great stuff with online ministry, Jason Moore. But one of the guys that I also love that is very open, like you can reach out to him. He actually emails back. It's nice when people, like when pastors actually email back. They're not always the best with that, but this guy's great at it. His name is Jay Cranda from Saddleback Church, and he met with me over Zoom. I saw him at conferences and phone calls as I was trying to figure out what it looked like. And he said something that has stuck with me that I feel like is how we need to perceive online ministry. And my idea is that I want to engage with people online, but I do believe that the best form of ministry is offline, in person. So my thought is I want to engage people online, but do my best to get them in community and maybe help them to find a ministry that's close to where they live. Or like if somebody watches me from another state and there's not a church close to them. And that's actually the case. There are some people who live in a spot where they could be an hour away from church. We have people who are part of our online ministry who are immune compromised, who the doctors tell them don't go into large gatherings. So online is the only thing that's available for them. And so that I'm so glad that they're joining along with us. But there's a lot of people that could find a community of faith around them. But for whatever reason, maybe they were hurt from a church in the past. Maybe they just moved into the area. And instead of going to five physical churches over 2 months' time, they can check out four churches on one Sunday through the stream. However I'm engaging with people, I want to lead, I want to connect with them. I want the digital to feel personal. They can connect with me. They can hear my voice. They can email me. They can call me. And I can help them, one, either get connected into a digital small group, which, let me tell you, online groups are so many good things can happen through that. I know there's a lot of pastors who throw hate towards it. And I just feel like that's so short-sighted. It's not seeing the possibilities of how some people, their first step might be a digital group. And maybe that might be the case for them for 6 months or a year. But I think there's something inside of us that does lead us towards personal connection. And we can help them find that in their discipleship journey. And as an online pastor, my job isn't for them to just join Victory. It's for them to be in community wherever they are. So if they're in Atlanta, please come to one of our four physical locations that we have in the Metro Atlanta area. But if you're in California, I'm going to help you find a great church. Maybe you go to their church. If they don't have small groups, be a part of our online group. 15 people meet every week at 7 p.m. Wednesday night on Zoom. You can be a part of that. And even if you look at how much telehealth has grown since the pandemic, most people prefer to meet with a therapist or a counselor over Zoom more than they do in person. And actually, you're more vulnerable. It's been proven that you're more vulnerable in those scenarios because there's an extra piece of anonymity that's there. So you feel more relaxed to be able to share how you're feeling than if you are, than maybe if you're in a big group of, you know, 15 people. It's online helps people to be more honest quicker. Just like the YouTube comment section, people could care less what they say there. They say horrible things, absolutely horrible things, whether it's YouTube, Reddit, 4chan, wherever, because they're anonymous. People don't know them. And they could be super honest with how they're feeling without trying to hide it. Because if you're honest where you go to work, that can come back to bite you. But online, you can be honest because these people don't know necessarily who you are. And you can be more real with them without there being, you know, less retribution afterwards.
Yeah.
So, okay. So
Yeah.
Make the digital personal. And I really feel like try to take online ministry, engage them there all day long, but gently try to help them find a place of worship, a friendship group, even if it's helping them create it in their own backyard.
Yeah. That's good. And I think, you know, you're talking about you developing a system and how that you have this person from Saddleback that is also mentoring, that's mentored you in some ways, but you're also mentoring all these people. So how do you think about systems and mentoring? Is it a conscious thing, or is it sort of just an organic expression?
Good question. Let me just say, nothing good in our lives ever happens by accident, you know, unless it's, if you want a six pack, you're not going to wake up one day and it's there. You know, if you want a healthy lifestyle, you just don't happen to turn in the corner and go, wow, I'm feeling really healthy today. Our bodies are breaking down all day long. You know, we're running towards death.
That's why you were selling the plot, right?
That's exactly why I would say yes, because it's there. You cannot outrun it or escape it. You know, that's one of the reasons why I'm not getting plugs, because I need people to see me die in front of them and get bald, and I'm not dye my gray hair, because all of us are getting old.
Yeah, we want to change reality. But I think the thing you were missing with your cemetery plot selling was you didn't have a shirt that said, I'm the Grim Reaper.
I need a scythe, a Sith, as I knock on the door, knock on it with this, and Hulk o'clock, tick tock, maybe it's today or next week. Yeah, that would have gotten me on a wanted list for sure. That would have been fun. So, like, back to like, how does mentoring happen? Is it organic, or do you have to be intentional about it? You listen. If you want somebody to mentor you, you have to go out there and find it. And if I want to mentor somebody, in today's age, I don't think people are looking for it as much, because they can see themselves being mentored through someone's content. So like, if I wanted to grow as a leader, I could read John Maxwell books for days, and I'm going to get so much really good information out of it. And with how many podcasts and YouTube content creators and everything that you can join to get really good leadership development, you can get a lot of good benefit from that. But like what I said earlier, there needs to be some type of personal connection as well. And we've got to ask people if we can learn from them. And I do think that if you want to be mentored, this is a mistake that I made. Okay, let me tell you a mistake that I made. I thought I had to wait until people asked me, hey, would you like for me to mentor you? But that should not be the case. We have to be aggressive in the way that we pursue it. You know, you have to look at someone and go, I like where they're at. I like how they handle their finances. I love the way that husband treats his wife. He's honorable to her, and she seems genuinely happy. I want that. My parents got a divorce, and that's what I learned growing up. That's what I know I'm going to lean towards that. I got to have somebody teach me another way. But those kind of things, you have to go out there and ask for it and go for it. And let me see, put some other encouragement out there as well. It's not just a one-time conversation. Okay. You can meet with somebody once, but you have to like continue to pursue them. It's not on them, I don't think, for it to happen. I think we have to put in some effort in order for us to see good fruit out of it, right? Not just a 30% return, but you got to put some elbow grease in there, and you only get out of it what you put into it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. What are some real or fictional stories, narratives that have shaped you as a person?
All right. Love Lord of the Rings. I am a Lord of the Rings nerd. Not quite like Colbert. Colbert can like answer all the different, you know, he can go back
Elvish poems
all the
way back to
yes, and he can speak Elvish. Yeah, I can't do any of that. But what I really liked about Lord of the Rings is how clearly the lines were with what's good and what's bad.
Okay.
You know, that to me, probably there's a reason why I think the best selling book of our, you know, a novel or, you know, fantasy of all time, is something that resonated with me when I watched the first movie. I loved the sense of community that it had, the fellowship and the friendship between Sam and Frodo and the friends. I so wanted close friends. So it spoke mm-hmm. something to me. So I read the books, and I love the aspect of courage, and I love the music. Like Howard Shore, you're never going to see this. I love you, brother. I don't know where you're at, but you are a, you're, what you've made has been a big benefit to me. So I love the music. I love the writing. I love the acting. I love the books and the movies, all that's except for whatever Amazon Prime did. Can we just pretend that that doesn't exist? This whole rings of power. All right. Listen, Bezos. No, I don't know what you guys did or what kind of writing that was, but if you could just maybe press reset, I don't know. Let's see what the second season looks like. Well, let me hold reserve on the second season. But that was a weird.
There's a book you might like from Fleming Rutledge, on Lord of the Rings. I have her book somewhere behind me, I think, about the crucifixion. But she wrote while I was reading it, I was like, oh, she wrote another book called The Battle for Middle Earth, and it's a commentary on Lord of the Rings, and it's really good stuff. So I'm gonna actually, I pulled a ton of quotes on it. I'll probably use it in the book that I'm working on. So, but yeah, you might love that for sure. So yeah. Go ahead.
If we're going to go with like fiction, I have one other fiction book that I really enjoyed reading called Ender's Game. That was about strategy and just a fun book by Orson Scott Card and some other, I read a couple of other ones in the series as well. Like one of my favorite quotes from that was about parenthood that just grabbed me, which was, how bad it is for the first child, because that's when the parents love the most and know the least. So they're so more apt to defend their wrong decisions.
Yeah.
And that's true. Like it's I love my oldest son, but I look at so many mistakes that I made with him.
Yeah.
my heart goes out to him.
Yeah. I only saw the movie. I haven't read the book of Ender's Game, but the ending, it wrecked me. Like it really, I'm still trying to reconcile what happened at the end of that movie, because it's such a, you think you're going down one road and you realize you've gone down a completely different road. And it's a powerful, powerful message. So.
Yeah, it was. It's, I love that kind of twist, that he brought to it and kind of what the volumes that it spoke. And I think that's probably, you know, the fiction aspect of it that I just really, really enjoy. I think a lot of the people, the biographies that I like to listen to right now are generally tied into comedians and the gift that they are to the world.
So you're really not joking around. Biased.
Yeah. oh, yes. Good job. I'm proud. Can we just put hand claps into the chat for that one? That was a beautiful pun. Good job. Good job.
Dad jokes and puns, that's my specialty.
please keep them coming. You see how I almost missed it? That would have been horrible. If you would have been like, hey, Steven, press pause. Maybe you could add laughter in the laugh track. sit me down, please.
So what are your final...
I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, tell us your final words of wisdom and we'll wrap it up here.
All right. Life sucks. Life is hard. Worst Bible promise ever is when Jesus said, in this world, you will have trouble. Just remember the last part of that, which is take heart, because I've overcome the world. Keep laughing. I mean, the word of God says it's like medicine for us. So that bad times are going to happen, but find ways to see joy in no matter what comes your way. There is good in it. In whatever we face, there's always good. And I want to re-say something I said earlier. Nothing good is going to happen by accident. If it's in your marriage or your finances or your job or personally, you have to be intentional towards what you want to go towards.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing. How can people connect with you? How do they find you online? How do they watch you in person as you're comedically telling stories of funniness?
Yeah. I do open mics around the Atlanta area as often as I can. I'll post them on my Instagram, which is Hadaway, Hataway, Picks, Pics. So you can find me there. I like to post where I'm going to be. And if you ever want to swing by and say hello to me, I'm at Victory Church on the weekend. I'm in Norcross. Please come up and say hello. I love to connect with people and be able to share some more about if you have any questions about my story, but I love hearing other people's story. That's what I love ministry is hearing what God is doing in other people's lives, and being able to hear their story just makes my heart happy.
Yeah. And I guess a really important question is, if there is a someone listening that is selling cemetery plots, can they come to Victory to sell one to you?
Listen, I would love to hear their pitch. Let me hear how it's changed in the past 15 years. That would make my heart happy. And I'll act like I haven't bought one. And I'll be like, please tell me. Oh, yeah, you're right. How can I sign the dotted line? I can't wait. I can't wait for someone to try it.
Yeah, it sounds good. Maybe you could buy one for pastors Dennis and Colleen. You know, as a birthday gift.
You know, I think that would be more likely of getting me fired instead of roasting him in front of his friends. I feel like that would be, it'd be like, this is the gift.
So
this
we've is gone too far. HR.
it might, I don't know. He might laugh. He might see it as a joke and think it's hilarious. But yeah, if I buy one, I'm going to gift it to him. That'd be a fun gift to open up on Christmas.
All right. Well, sounds good. Thank you, Stephen, for sharing your life with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Share Life. For additional stories and systems to live better and work smarter, visit jasonscottmontoya.com. That's jasonscottmontoya.com. We look forward to having you listen in on the next episode of Share Life.